You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
The 3CR Gardening Show is coming to you today from the Woi Wurrung Nation. We acknowledge the Wurundjeri people as the traditional owners of this land. We recognise the practices of care and cultivation of the land and waters by the First Peoples and pay our respects to their elders past and present. Wherever you are and wherever you garden, we encourage you to know whose land you're on. Good morning, near and far. You are tuned in to the 3CR Gardening Show on this moist Sunday morning. I'm Chloe Foster and I'm very happy to be here, especially because of the two wonderful panellists in front of me this morning. Their faces are still covered in red sand because I didn't want to wash the memories of a recent jaunt to the Red Centre away. So welcoming to the microphones, Emmeline Bowman, Chief of STEM Landscape Architecture.
I wouldn't say Chief. I'm
I think they run you sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. Good morning.
Good morning. And A.B. Bishop, Horticulture Editor of Gardening Australia Magazine and author.
Good morning, everybody. Lovely to be here.
Very happy to have you both in today.
We're back together again.
We are back together again.
I feel like we're all having, this time last week we were all having withdrawal symptoms. Mm-hmm. I certainly was having a big come down from being an Alice for 8 days, yeah, which was an absolute joy and treat. All things native plants for the Native Plant Conference. Yeah. And, be back and just to have it sort of filtering through slowly and working out what I've learned and all the things that I haven't learned that I want to learn and all the plants which we think, like, you kind of get, then you half recognise.
Yep.
And then you realise you've got no idea what it is. It's really, even things like the brachyscomb, I'm like, that is definitely a brachyscomb. And of course it's not.
What, the Allaria brachyscomb? Yeah.
I had no idea between those two whether it was Allaria or brachyscomb.
Oh, I miss it. It was definitely like that involvement of just being really in nature. I think the pace slowed down as well, so we could just sort of, like, you really kind of reflect on what's happening back here at home in Melbourne, where everything's just so fast-paced.
It's a rat race.
It is a rat race, and, you know, it's that thing of coming back to, like, that simplicity of nature where it's like, you know, you're following the days. The people still follow the days when it's not built up as much. And then, yeah, of course, looking at the wildlife and the plants and how everything's working together in such a way, the diversity of species, the same issues and complex situations between people, plants and ecology and mining and all those sort of things, mm-hmm, and weed species. And then obviously the overload of information when you're like, oh my God, now I've forgotten everything I even know.
Yeah, I know.
Like, I feel like I erased other parts to be able to get more information in. My hard drive is full. I'm deleting files. But yeah.
And I mean, it's obvious that we can still do that here at home, but I think when you're taken out of your home environment and put in this beautiful landscape and area, which is so new to you, and there's no housework to be done. There's only a little bit of work to be done. All those things. There's all this empty time, and all you have to do is examine the plants that are around you and the landscapes and the critters, and take it all in. But of course, we can still do that here at home.
Yeah, but it is different. It sort of feels like when you're, you know, might be sort of like at that kid stage. You know, when mum and dad are looking after life for you, you actually get to like fully involve yourself in something where you don't have to worry about, you know, the bills being paid or, you know, work and all those sort of things. It felt like a, you know, I mean, that's what holidays are for, but it does kind of remind you of how much we do.
Yeah. And for people that don't know, it was the Australian Native Plant Society biannual conference and was in Alice Springs, Mpantwe, and on the arid flora of Australia. And it was quite an exceptional experience. We were in lectures for part of it, sort of half an hour to 45-minute lectures by incredible incredibly knowledgeable people on the flora of that area, and interspersed with day trips and half-day trips, exploring places like the Olive Pink Botanic Garden and the Desert Park.
Alice Springs Desert Park was a highlight.
It really was.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. The thing about that is it's so good to be able to see all the different sort of ecosystems that surround Alice, and they've sort of brought them into this one particular area where you can see clay pans and sand pans and all those sorts of things, as well as all the flora of the area that's all sort of been brought in together, as well as the birds and all those different critters. I have to say a highlight for me was seeing the spiny devil.
Oh, the spiny devil. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. When I was about eight, I was still living in South Africa, and my auntie was living in Australia, and she sent us this book, and it was on the spiny devil. And ever since then, I've been quite infatuated by the spiny devil, because it's just a creature like no other. Mm. Just this little lizard that sort of moves in a very robotic way, spines all over its body, and it drinks by when there's dew or the occasional rain, it hits the spines and then forms a little channel into its mouth, and that's the way it drinks. Like,
it
what the hell?
Thousands of ants.
Yeah.
Like thousands of those disgusting things. But it doesn't even look like it would be a real creature.
No.
It's like it could be a Pokemon or something. Yeah. It's just incredibly magical little creature.
Have to be the inspiration for a Pokemon character for sure.
Surely.
Yeah.
And Chloe was very, very excited before we were going, I have to say, when we booked a nocturnal trip to Alice Springs Desert Park, where you go into this big area and you see amazing creatures like the greater bilby. And, yes, Chloe said, oh, I might even jump the fence. And I said, well, you don't have to jump the fence because you'll be right in there with them.
I think you've still got bruises on your arm from when I grabbed you when I saw the bilby the first time.
But even – and things like the greater stick rat.
Oh, the greater stick nest rat.
Yeah, which was pretty special as well. I mean, we have so many incredible little mammals and marsupials, don't we? And you don't really get to experience them and realise the diversity of them.
I didn't realise the diversity until we were at the desert park of what we actually, well,
had.
Mm. Yeah. The, you know, so many different sorts
the
of
mala.
Betongs.
The betongs. Yeah. We have so many betongs. The mala was one. I never didn't know. I knew about betongs, but I didn't actually know about the mala.
Mm-hmm.
But it's obviously it gets incredibly sad when you – it's the same with like bandicoots and betongs. I used to say back in the day, you know, you'd walk through tussock-rich fields and the, you know, the marsupials and little mammals would scatter beneath your feet. And they said the same thing with the mala. There was just so many that they would just be basically booting them off, and to the point now that they're basically extinct if they're external from some sort of predator-proof fence.
Yep.
And then within this facility, did they have, what was it, it was like 400 in their breeding? They started off with 80 or something?
Yeah, so they're very successful when they're actually given a chance.
When they're given a chance, and it's the same, like they use those and they're putting them into other breeding programs around Central Australia. But, it was cute. They're like tiny. They're more related to the kangaroo.
Well, their other name is the Rufous Hare Wallaby.
Oh, Rufous Hare Wallaby.
But, yeah, they're mainly known as the mala.
Yes. And what, they're about 30 centimetres tall?
Yep.
Yeah.
And to see creatures like that hopping around the place, it honestly looks like your teddy bear collection has come to life.
Really does.
Yeah.
So, that was pretty special. I mean, sad in one way to know that they're only sort of in this large enclosed environment, but still good to know that at least there's a sort of captive breeding situation happening.
And very successful.
Yeah.
So if we were ever able to eradicate all our issues, we would have them all right back easily.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the Arid Recovery Reserve, which they did at one of the final talks of the conference, they've been breeding the malas as well and maybe another type of betong.
Yeah.
And their breeding program was unbelievably successful too, that they had to
introduce predators.
predators, but to send them, I think they sent them to other properties.
Yeah, and the bilby as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was quite phenomenal what – well, it, no, when – So from a plant perspective, when areas are fenced off and excluded from introduced animals, like the response you see from the environment, but I was I was sort of quite blown away to see that from an animal perspective as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And just so there's two ways about it too. It's like if you have too many species in one area of flora, it's like, yeah, you can eat it all and devastate it. But at the same time, these species, when we didn't have any predators, would have these open areas and would be cultivating the land. A lot of our marsupial species around Australia were digging and cultivating the land. They were basically oxygenating the soil. They were getting all those tuberous roots, depositing their fecal matter, which produces a food source for the plants. So there was all these systems that we have lost because of, yeah, we've lost all these species as well. But then it can go the other way. Mm. Like we did see them in these protection reserves, and then they just bred to the point of like almost drought disaster.
Yeah.
And this is where there's always that balance that comes back. So, yeah, it's always good to have those reminders, and it's fascinating to observe. But, yeah, animals and plants are like everything's so important. Yeah.
What were your planty highlights of Central Australia, you two?
Gosh, there were so many, weren't
there? There were so many.
Yeah, and I mean, even from day one, there were things that we didn't know. You know, I'm thinking of the native borage, the Trichodesma, which was this just beautiful little sort of perennial shrub, which
herbaceous.
I want one.
Yeah.
Which, I want many.
Which would look at home in any cottage garden, certainly in the ones that you design, Em. It would,
I would.
Just had a typical blue borage flower and was probably about 40, 50 centimetres tall. And, yeah, there were just swathes of it in some places. So I think the, I mean, yeah, again, so many new ones. We went to a indigenous nursery called Centralian Indigenous Plants, run by a sole owner, Jürgen, whose surname I can't remember. But he had grown species from around the Northern Territory and were able to see them pretty much in situ, in a way similar to Karanga Nursery, where they've got the display beds to be able to see these plants growing. A lot of Eremophilas, of course. I mean, the deserts are renowned for just being having a huge diversity of Eremophilas, and to be able to see all the different species in situ was quite incredible, and to be able to compare them. So for me, the Eremophilas, because they bring a really beautiful kind of a brightness almost to the desert, where, you know, a lot of plants you don't necessarily expect to see that sort of those bright greens and bright colours in a desert environment. But I think that was one of the real surprises for me. So the Eremophilas, and what was that one? The cockroach senna or something?
Oh my God, I love that. The cockroach bush.
The cockroach bush.
Yeah, yes. I love the cockroach bush.
That
yeah.
was incredible. So, I mean, not only the flowers were amazing, but the seed pods, yeah. which looked like native cockroaches.
Yeah, really
like, how could
that.
You ever forget that?
yeah. I think my highlight, like, so Egle and I, one of my staff, we went on a trip down to Uluru, and we did actually on the last day as well, all of us, we did the side road look, you know, with all the wildflowers that happen on the verge of roadsides. I think my highlights were definitely those parts where we got to see the most incredible wildflowers. Like, you know, even it was just like similar things we saw in Victoria, like the Brunonias, but sweeps of them. Like, yeah. It's just so many of them. I'd say Tolotus fields were just phenomenal. So many different species.
So many different types. Oh, yeah. Macrocephalus was just incredible.
It was just like, just seas of it. And when we were down in Catachucha, like literally we were looking at probably acres of them, just all underneath the mountains and all the rock formations. But yeah, I would also say that what was really interesting when we did speak with Jorgen, was it the desert walnut or which was it that?
There
was
the desert plum. The semi-parasitic one?
The one where it would produce a hard nut, and he had observed that
I know what you're going to say.
Yeah, that the termites would actually eat around the hard crust of that nut, which then exposed the seed inside, and that's part of the germination. Like that, you know, that observation to be able to, yeah, understand that germination. I was like, oh, my God. It kind of like went down this spiral because I was like, oh, my God, so many plants do that and they're relying on that insect activity or something to break that hard shell that encapsulates it and to let it free and to grow. So I was like, oh, you know, it was just, there was those things.
That was incredible. And he'd been trying to germinate this plant and then suddenly thought, well, why don't I just work with nature? And he made a little shallow depression in the ground and put them in there and left them. And, yeah, as Em said, the termites came and ate the outer casing. And, I mean, and that's the same with ants as well, isn't it? You know, a lot of ants will take seeds down into their nests underground just to eat part of the seed but not the entire seed itself, and then that leaves the seed there to germinate. So, yeah, there's just so much close interaction between animals and plants. Mm. And I think being in the desert, you really notice it more.
Yeah. And so many ants. Like, there were so many insects and ants, especially. Yeah. It was ants like per every square meter. I would observe when we were going through the part of the desert, I was just like, ant. They were like, there were some that you could see were like complete colonies, and I'd say they were spreading like as far as they could. I don't know, it's probably like 10, 20 meters of ant colony. But then there'd be different species. So it's just like the whole floor is alive and they're working underground as well. And I think what else was really interesting about the plants was like there was that talk about, you know, why there isn't any cacti in Australia. Yeah. And the fact is that they didn't actually need more water, and these plants are even more drought tolerant than these species.
That was really cool, wasn't it?
Yeah. And the development of the taproot and how, you know, the underwater systems and the water systems that they're driving that water up.
I haven't looked further into like the geology of, you know, either Africa or Northern America.
Mm.
But, you know, we know that Australia has extensive groundwater systems.
Huge.
And the plants have obviously evolved in response to that by, developing taproots and to, you know, to hit the ground.
Yeah. And that soil, it like, because it's a bit like when we create the wetland soil, you know, you put a whole lot of sand and silty stuff together and you get, it almost turns to concrete if you ever like got it wet and then let it dry, you know, it does in a way. But at the same time, it's really permeable. And what's happening is when you do have water seeping above and even below that water table, you're getting a wicking response. And those plants, if they've got a very, you know, elongated taproot, they were even saying with the river red gums, and they've got like longer
taproot. Incredibly long taproot. Yeah.
Mm. And so these species are like tapping in, literally. Mm. And, you know, even when you're if you're flying, you can actually see the veins of the water courses where the plants are sitting in that ecology, driving that water back up. And obviously you get periods where it does get really, really dry, and we're in a very wet period because we were very lucky to go there and it was wet.
It was one of the wettest Augusts that they've had. It's usually the driest month.
Yeah. So we saw something very unique, and we saw the plants, you know, coming back at a force. And when it gets dry, these plants then go dormant. They die and not die, they're actually sort of dormant, or they're releasing a seed that can be stored in the ground for like, what, 6, 7, even some of them were like up to 20 years.
Yeah.
This is incredible. Where was I going with this?
I don't know, but one of the things that really struck me was the river red gum, the Eucalyptus camelgulensis, which is found all over Australia, but in the arid parts of Australia, it's the subspecies.
Arida.
And it's a pretty much quite a different form. It's almost like a mallee form, like it produces a number of trunks so that if one of them can't cope with a drought, the others will survive. And it also has an incredible adaptation to be able to expel water. So these trees in the centre of Australia are growing in essentially dry river beds, which obviously at particular times of the year are flooded, and they've developed this adaptation to be able to expel excess water when they need, which I think is quite incredible.
Weren't they saying that they have a really big taproot to tap into the groundwater at whatever depth it is? But they produce fibrous, like lateral fibrous roots, which was sort of blowing my mind a little bit. That hang around and tolerate
just little drops.
Periods of inundation.
Yeah. So that was pretty special. So what was your favourite, Chloe?
Okay, thank you for asking. Sorry, I've been waiting for you asking that. No, it was two, and my poor diploma students copped it the other day. I was like, guys, I just need to tell you about these two plants. the desert flannel flower, Actinotus schwartzii, which is like our regular flannel flower's sexier, leggier cousin. So the flower can be the size of your palm, and it's got, it's not a petal, but the flannel flowers have, it's a bract. So, but they have sort of long, thinner bracts than what our standard, what I'm calling Actinotus helianthi, has. Growing on cliff faces, and that's the only place it grows. And I didn't know this. So this is like a crazy level of endemism with this plant. And I didn't know about this before we went up there, and someone told me about it. I was like, oh, my God, I need to see that. And so it grows in Stanley Chasm, which is in the West McDonnell Ranges. And I was having a look on iNaturalist and Atlas of Living Australia last night. There's a couple of other observations of it in maybe Serpentine Gorge or something, which is a little bit further up. But it's literally growing on the sides of these cliff faces, and that grow, and that species is nowhere else in the world. There's Eastern States species of Actinotus, there's WA species of Actinotus, and then there's this one species just hanging out in a couple of, on a couple of cliff faces in the West McDonnell Ranges.
We just looked up and you see them. If only they're in flower.
Oh, they're in flower. They, well, my other plant of the trip was in flower there. Man, that was so cool. So we went, you and I, while Em jaunted off down to Uluru, you and I jaunted west into the West McDonnell Ranges, and we went to Stanley Chasm. And if anyone does go up there, Stanley Chasm is about 40 minutes out of Alice. You don't need a four-wheel drive to get there. If you want to see a lot of cool endemic flora, there's kind the of all there, bar for maybe like the yellow casuarina. And so the macadamia McDonnellii, the blue cycad, is there. But the other cool thing that we saw in Stanley Chasm itself was this, this like green herbaceous thing with white droopy flowers. And I was staring at it going, what the hell is that? I have no idea. Is it a scovola? Is it a goodenia? What is it? So it stayed with me all day. And I was like, I could not, I was flicking through the books, couldn't work it out. I was on iNaturalist trying to find observations for the cat. Like, this was probably what went on for 2 hours when we got home. And I ended up sending a couple of very average photos to our good friend Adrian Keane. And I was like, mate, help me out here. I know you're in Melbourne, but this is driving me nuts. So he, I don't know, must have got on the desktop or something. Came back. It's the cliffside daisy called Cremnothamnus thomsonii. And it also only grows on rock crevices in the McDonnell Ranges. That's it. And also, I found out last night, it is monotypic. So it's the only, there's that genus, and there's the, that's the only species within it. So it is a daisy, but that's the only species of it.
Really?
Yeah, and it's this one just that is centered in the McDonnell Ranges.
Yeah, well, well done to Adrian for working that out from your blurry photos.
Oh, I was so impressed. And I did see it at Ellery Big Hole when we were
up the top,
on the rocks there.
When AB and Laura just swam out and we chickens stay at the front.
Like, I need to have my feet on the ground.
Very impressed.
I was very impressed.
That was a good swim. Yeah, it was cold. It wasn't as cold once you were in and your body was adjusted. And as Chloe was saying, it's good in the top 10 centimetres.
We were floating.
Like a seal.
Like planks on the top of the level.
But honestly, I think August was such a good time to visit the centre.
Yeah.
The weather and was lovely.
It was beautiful. This city, the town itself is so clean, so pretty. Jeff Myers is a local sort of legend landscaper from the area who's lived there for a squillion years, and he has done all the public amenity plantings and done such an incredible job. And what I loved is even things like the – and you pretty much pointed this out to me because obviously that's your area of expertise. All the benches, all the rubbish bins, just works of art in themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, it was the perfect example of good design where you design to your surroundings. Like if you're, if you've got this red desert, then you know, you make sure infrastructure and buildings sort of complement the red dirt, you know, have those complementary colours of ochres and, you know, yellows and oranges and, you know, those natural colours. As AB said, the benches, the bins, even the power poles were made of steel, so they rusted like a core 10. Just so lovely.
And the public fences were made to look like the McDonnell Ranges.
Exactly. They had just like the mountain ranges, and it was just like all these tie back to nature. All the plantings were, you know, from either the local area or not far. And so it just complemented all the vegetation. The layout, the paving details, everything was just done to reflect the area.
Yeah.
The environment, the plants, the animals, even the street art was like the local ecology, like local animal species and ecology. I was like, this is good design. Yeah. And then, you know, this is why when you go to other places where you think, why does this not look good? It's because there's no complement.
Yeah.
It's so void from its natural environment, or not even, it's like so artificial.
Been done as cheaply as possible.
As cheaply as possible. And it just looks so artificial that you're like, I don't know why this looks so ugly. It's because it's just, ugh. Can't even. So, yeah, it was really nice to see that compliment. And I just, it's a bit like old Melbourne. Like before we have all these like modern buildings, it's like Melbourne would have had to use the local geology. That's why you see the old bluestone buildings. And, you know, they always say Melbourne's a bit grey. But, yeah, it's going to be grey because that is the geology of the site.
Yeah.
And they would have back then, that's why you can still see remnants of like they would have had like all your different types of eucalypts or even just the ferns. You know, you used to see tree ferns in the garden, especially when you go down to like North Melbourne and, you know, all those areas you see tree ferns. They used to use all those plants and you would see that complement and then slowly and slowly and slowly it goes and it's gone. And yeah, but it was really nice to even see like in people's gardens around Alice Springs. And obviously it's also because the availability of plants isn't there, but not as many exotic species. They're still there, but it was still using the native vegetation within the gardens, within the streets and the parklands. And I think it comes through.
I think what Jeff Myers was saying is that there has been, and what you're seeing across the board with GA Magazine, AB, there has been an increase in people in Alice wanting to plant local flora, which is really encouraging.
To the point, I thought it was really funny. So Jeff, as I was saying, he was planting up all the public amenities and he had planted Rhodanthe chlorocephala, which is indigenous to WA. And honestly, it looked freaking amazing. Yeah. But everybody was getting on his goat for not planting Alice Springs indigenous plants.
Yeah.
But it did look good.
Yeah. Like that, what was the egg and
the poached egg daisy?
The poached egg. What's that? What's the botanical name of that one again?
Polycalima.
Stewartii. That was beautiful. Like imagine if they had seeds of that.
I know.
Or the little patch that we saw on the side of the road with the shonia.
So we were very lucky enough to get a quick but private tour of the Alice Springs Desert Park nursery.
Yeah.
On the morning that we left from Michael Burnham.
Yep.
Is from Melbourne, from Vinc originally, which we love Vinc, and he's working as a horticulturalist up in the Desert Park now. We met him at the conference and he showed us around the nursery in the morning before we went away. And what I found, one of the things he said that was really interesting was there is a big green shed in Alice and there are plants that you can buy there that you can also buy in Melbourne and Brisbane, but the desert levels them out pretty quickly. They either get fried by the freezing winter frosts that they have or they die in winter.
Yeah. Yep.
So, but the other thing that was interesting seeing being grown up there was the amount of subtropical trees. And you and I joined ABC Alice Springs for their gardening show with Jeff Myers and Stuart Brash. It was so fun to join them. They were talking about one street in Alice has recently been planted with crepe myrtles and the residents were like, why did they put crepe myrtles? Like,
I'm so glad there's a backlash.
Yeah. And there's a few other subtropical trees that I was quite surprised at how well they were doing in such a dry, harsh environment because the subtropics, yes, it's hotter, but it's a lot wetter as well.
I'm just showing Chloe the one of the trees which was a bit of a standout for me was the Gumby, the Pittosporum angustifolium, which is a gorgeous sort of weeping smallish tree, which it, like it was in the Olive Pink Garden and it was fruiting at the time. And I'd written about it in a story recently, and so sort of knew it, but not in person, so to speak. So to see it and to realise that, yes, these birds are going nuts for the fruit itself, it, you know, after having written about that, it was really good to see in person. I just think that plant could be in anybody's garden.
It's tough. It is in gardens. And if you want to go see specimens, you can just go to Cranbourne and see them, because they're fantastic ones there.
Yeah.
And we've been putting them.
They've been fruiting?
Yeah.
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 Well, that's really interesting. It's like this plant growing in this arid zone, but also grows down in Melbourne where we're, you know, it's a totally different climate, warm temperate. And some of the plants like the Cremnothamnus and the Actinotus that we saw, and I was speaking to Michael yesterday about the cultivation of those two species, particularly the desert the desert flannel flower and the cliff daisy, because he has the cliff daisy growing in pots in the nursery there. So it does grow on flat ground. And he said he reckons it'd be really good for cultivation. It'd probably need, you know, it'd do well in a pot in a drier spot or in a mounded garden bed with well-drained soil. Yeah. But it was the stuff that we saw, I was like, and we're talking to people about where they grow and how they grow. And I think the three of us were saying the whole time, AB, you and I said to each other heaps, like, these would be suited to growing down in Melbourne. Why aren't we? I mean, there's so much stuff you could be growing.
But you could almost make it a weed. They could become weedy too. We've got to be careful.
Yeah, you
have to. Like the Trichodesma, I was like, oh, yeah, that's amazing. I would love it in my garden. And I was like, it's doing very well.
It's doing very well up there, but I wonder if the cool, wet winter might stop it from spreading. Well, or there's the trials. Or it might make it spread further.
Yes.
That's what we don't know.
Yeah. I guess the thing is, and what I observed is, they either survive or thrive, right? So when it comes into periods that we just observed, it was wet. And like I said, the soil, when it got wet, you could literally, like, it was moist, you know. It held that moisture and the plants were just thriving off it. So I guess it's a bit like when they introduced the blackberries into Maine, Australia. There's 24/7 season for them. There was no period to let them sit. So they should do well. Like, all those flowering species have got constant, like, moisture. They won't have to do the, you know, I've just got to wait out another year for the water, you know. It's going to be nice, so they should be able to just keep going. Mm. Not for all of them, of course, but that's what you're sort of observing, is in good times they're going to put on their leaf.
Yeah, and one of the things that we learned in one of the lectures was when there's winter rain up there, that is supporting that sort of herbaceous group of plants, and then when it's summer rain, that's supporting the native grasses. So it was good to be up there during winter rain, knowing that a lot of these plants are being able to be supported through what is probably going to be quite a long, hot, dry summer.
Dare I say, that also brings me to the sad thing of the bloody buffel grass when they said about the grasses. Are we not going to talk about buffel?
Yes, we are talking about buffel.
We'll do that later. Let's talk about buffel. Let's talk about buffel in a minute. I must remind listeners that you are tuned into the 3CR Gardening Show. I'm Chloe Foster, and in the studio with me this morning is AB Bishop and Emmeline Bowman. We have been waxing lyrical about a beautiful trip we've been on recently to the Australian Native Plant Society biennial conference that was hosted in Alice Springs. A few people have sent through some text messages already, which I'll get to in a moment. But if you would like to join the chat, if you've got a gardening question, please give us a call on 94190155. The text line is 0488 809 855. We'll put some photos of some of these special plants on the 3CR Instagram and Facebook pages. You can find us, 3CR Gardening Show is our handle for both of those. For anyone tuning in later, hello to you podcasters. You know, we're on all the podcasting apps too. So give us a call, 94190155. A couple of text messages to get to. Cheryl in Bitten, very organised. Once again, Cheryl, when is the best time to plant gladiolus corms? Should you pre-sprout them? Springtime is the best time to plant them so that they don't get hit by any frosts. Pre-sprouting, it probably depends on the cultivar, but you may not have to. Cheryl, next time Jane Tonkin is in or Greg Balderston, please message in again, because they will be able to give you way more information than what any of us can. Pia has messaged in, which Pia, our lovely producer, thanks for giving everyone major FOMO for missing out on the APS conference. just joking. Lovely to hear about all the amazing plants. Pia was at Ved Square yesterday.
She was.
MAPCO and Larkbundup were hosting a plant party, and there are a number of local garden clubs and nurseries that had it set up there. There were people everywhere, which was wonderful to see. The newest Australian Plant Society group also had a presence there, and Pia was on that stand with a couple of other legends, Matt and Dan.
Yeah.
So it was great to see them, you know, sharing the love for Melbourne's flora and Australia's flora. They've got a talk coming up in a couple of weeks on small eucalypts as well in North Melbourne.
It's great, all these like younger people and groups of, you know, into plants, APS societies.
And when we were at Alice, I have to say, so there were 325 attendees at the conference, and I was very happy to be lumped in with the young group, which was Chloe and Em and Em's team. So that we were the young ones that were getting around the place. But
there were a few others.
Yeah,
but they didn't have grey hair.
No, but how nice was it that the older patrons were just like, it's so great to see you, and the encouragement, the enthusiasm, like it was really, really special. And you know, they're actively trying. They're like, "How can we get more of you? How do we get you?" Like, life gets tough, but we'll be here. But no, it was really, really nice.
And if anyone's also having FOMO, there's a conference in the next conference is in Toowoomba,
2 years,
which in 2 years' time, and that's already being looking really good in terms of the tours that they've got planned.
Yeah, so they're going to focus on the flora of the sort of western scenic side of rim, the Great Divide. So that, maybe into the hinterland a little bit, which is beautiful up there.
Yeah.
So Toowoomba, the town, isn't as exciting as Alice Springs. No offence.
It's a really gardening town, though.
It is a big gardening town. Mm. We could be pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the soil there is terrific.
We'll be going anyway. Yeah, good soil. Yeah.
It's not like Bundaberg. Sorry. Anyone from Bundaberg.
No. God, we don't want to get hate mail.
No, I know.
We do have a phone call to get to on the line. Good morning to Bern.
Oh, good morning. Mm. How are you? Have a chat, Hero.
Hi, good. Dude. How are you, Bern?
Good, thank you. Guys, I've been trying to get rid of my oxalis and solarising, putting black plastic to solarise, cut it all back. And it's working really well. But I went to move it the other day and a beautiful blue tongue lizard has taken up residence, which I'm so excited about. But I need to move the plastic. I remember seeing a little story about Emmeline making or getting some lizard boxes, and I'm wanting to buy them, get some ideas about making a lizard box so I can make him a little house where he can live. It's going to be all habitat garden now.
Oh, that's cute. I made those boxes, so you can't really buy them. But it wouldn't really work for him anyway, because he's not going to want to live in something like that. He likes your black plastic because it's nice and warm for winter. So if anything, it might be a really good way is, you know, the like the old cement pipes or the terracotta pipes?
Mm.
Sometimes you can still find them. You can make like a little habitat of that. And then it's so, and you put position it so it gets a little bit of that eastern, maybe a bit of northern sun, because it'd be more for the winter that it wants to hang out there. If you move the tarp now, like it might be a little bit early because it's going into spring and he's still looking for a bit of warmth. So if you want to move it, be better to move his little house in those warmer months so then he or she can go off and go eat snails and things in the garden. But yeah, if you want to make like a cluster, and I like, that's why we use rocks or we use those little pipes. You just make a cluster of little caves and little homes and then plant around it and make it look really beautiful. And then you also create like habitat too for other skinks in your garden too, you'll find. Yeah.
Bern, one of the things that I do when I'm doing up a new garden bed, I'll use like pieces of corrugated iron or even metal baking trays got from the op shop, and you just create a bit of a shallow depression in the ground and put the piece of tin down, hold it down with whatever you want, a couple of bricks, and then cover it with mulch. So it's got a bit of an opening and it's closed at the back and big enough for skinks and the blue tongues.
That's a really good way too. Yeah, really nice.
And I've got some old roof tiles. I thought they could work.
Perfect.
Absolutely. They're so good. And if you do it in different ways, if you even did like, say if you had larger openings for, say, something for like the blue tongue, but then keep those smaller slithers and layer them, then that's great for all the skinks and for your geckos and things like that. Yeah. And even insects, so then they can have a feed or they can have a home. Yeah.
Great.
You can have fun.
Yeah. Lovely. All right.
Thanks, Bern. Thanks for calling in. We'll see you soon.
See you later. Bye-bye.
Bye. Good on Bern for thinking about the skinks.
Love Bern.
Yeah. Yep. She's
Bern cares.
Yes.
It's actually pretty easy to create habitat.
It's so easy.
For critters, regardless whether you're thinking of insects or lizards. And, just create lots of nooks and crannies, get by in some small rocks, which are easy to move, and just by piling them on top of each other and planting some grasses around it, very, very quickly you've got good habitat.
Exactly. Just got to mimic.
Yeah, just lots of holes.
Give them heaters, natural heaters.
Yeah.
Like, we don't want to be cold. Do you want to be cold? I hate being cold.
No.
Poor little Lizzies.
All right, I think it's time to get to some community announcements. There's a few happening. It's really cool to see. I remember when a few years ago when we started hosting the gardening show after Pam retired and COVID happened, that horrible thing, and there was just not much going on. But we are back into full swing now, which is really encouraging. So let's get going. Still on this weekend is the Ferny Creek Spring Extravaganza. It finishes, so it's open and finishes today. There's a huge range of growers that go to Ferny Creek. Jane and Kirill, Jane Tonkin with Tonkin's Bulbs and Perennials is there. Hancock's Daffodils, Fresbrook Peony Farm as well. Entry is $9. Children are free. So that's on today at 100 Hilton Road, Sassafras. Next weekend, on Saturday the 12th and Sunday the 13th of September, is the Australian Plant Society, Australian Plants Expo, which is being held by the Yarra Yarra Group. This is a really awesome native plant expo that the Yarra Group holds each year. It's at Eltham Community and Reception Centre on Main Road in Eltham. Huge displays and expo of Australian plants, grafted species, uncommon, lots of Mim with her mints is usually there as well if you want some of our native prostanthras. There's gardening books and related resources as well. So that's Saturday and Sunday the 12th and 13th of September, which is next weekend. Starting next weekend and running through to the 11th of October is the Tessalar Tulip Festival. 357 Monbulk Road, Sylvan. It's their huge spring celebration with fields and fields of blooming tulips. They've got live entertainment, market stalls, and different themes on each day. Children under 17 are free. Adult tickets are $39.50. It's a really fun day out for families, and the little kids usually love it, just running through these rows and rows of beautiful bright tulips. On Saturday the 19th of September, this is an exciting one for native plant people because Maranoa Botanic Gardens turns 100. Ooh. It is, and that's 100 years of being open as a public garden. So it's a little bit older than that when it was owned privately. Maranoa Gardens is in Baldwin, in east inner Melbourne. It's a really beautiful, established native garden. Bit of a hidden gem. If you haven't been there before, then next Saturday is probably the time to go. They've got a fair bit going on. So they're running a few different guided plant walks throughout the day. At 11 a.m. and 1 p.m., there is a guided eucalyptus walk at 1 p.m. There is a nature journaling workshop. And the other cool thing they're doing is they're running a sustainable Halloween spider web workshop. I cannot get around Halloween. I hate it so much. The thing I hate the most about it is those fake spider webs. It's just bad stringy plastic. It's so bad for our animals.
It makes me so angry.
Me too.
It actually, like, I see red. And I don't even want – why – I'm not into this Halloween either. No, like, why do we want to be like America?
Mate, I cannot get around it either.
Sorry, people.
It's not an Australian thing.
It's not.
The UK and the US can have it. There's like – it's a thing over there. It is not an Australian thing, and it's just about lollies, and I hate it so much.
Yeah, it's bad for your teeth. You're looking after sugar companies and you're spreading plastic. It's like everything that we're not doing anymore, people.
Yeah, I think it's an excuse to get together with kids. I think we need to create something Australian.
You make it like dress up like animals or something. Dress up like Australian spiders, but don't do freaking fake spider webs.
I know.
so what's with the spiders?
Sorry, that really got us all ranted.
Thank you, everyone. If you're still tuning in, thanks for listening.
Yeah, sorry.
Maranoa Gardens are doing a sustainable Halloween spider web workshop next Saturday. I don't know how they're going to do it, but that's cool. I can get around that. So they've got live entertainment and music there as well. You do need to register for the walk, so please jump onto the Burundara City Council, City of Burundara website for that. On Saturday the 19th of September as well is the Melbourne Clivia Group Expo at Burwood East Uniting Church. We have two double passes for our listeners. If you would like to call on 94190155 to pick up those double passes. The show is celebrating all the different rare and beautiful flowering clivias. There's demonstrations, propagations, etc. There's a whole heap. On Saturday the 19th and the 20th of September as well is the Angare Wildflower Show down in Anglesey. So we have a really diverse coastal heathland down on our Great Ocean Road. And the Angare Wildflower Group has a celebration of this with their local arts community in the Anglesey Memorial Hall. So that's the 19th and the 20th of September. You can find more information on their website, which is www.angair.org.au. Also on Sunday the 20th of September, I'm doing a nature strip planting and design workshop with the Burundara City Council. If anyone would like to jump in on that, there's still some spots available. You can book on the City of Burundara's website. A few days before that, AB is doing a webinar tied into the nature strip planting workshop on how to remove lawn.
Yes, how to remove turf from your verge.
Oh, good on you.
So we've sort of teamed up, but not physically, to do that. So learn with AB how to remove your lawn and learn with me how to make it really nice once you've ripped it all up. There's more on the Burundara Council website for that. The Pomonal Flower Show, which is one of the best flower shows. AB's got a hand up. She's going. Take your habitat book. Get her to sign it. The 3rd and 4th of October at the Pomonal Community Hall, they are showcasing the beauty of Australian flora. Visitors can enjoy plant displays, expert gardening demonstrations, and local nursery tours. Entry is $7 and kids are free. There's more information on apsvic.org.au website for that. So that's the 3rd and 4th of October, which if anyone's into footy, it's the weekend after grand final weekend. Bolabek Garden Fair is also on that weekend, the 3rd and 4th of October, up in the Macedon Ranges. So if you want to stay a bit closer to home, it's less than an hour from Melbourne. There's at least 50 specialist plant growers that are going to be there. There's guided tours of the historic site, this historic house and garden. One of the guest speakers there is Joe Lawson. Entry is $20. There's a couple more. Royal Botanic Gardens of Cranbourne Friends Plant Sale is on the 10th and 11th of October. This is where to get some really cool, unique Australian plants. They grow stuff collected from the Australian garden and a little bit further afield. It's all volunteer run and all proceeds go towards supporting projects at the Royal Botanic Gardens in Cranbourne. So that's the 10th and 11th of October. The Gippsland Rare and Unusual Plant Fair, and I had a text message to get to for that one, is on Saturday the 10th of October at Broughton Hall from 9 a.m. till 4 p.m. The address for that at Broughton Hall is 125 Palmer Road, Jindavik. There's about 40 different stall holders that are going to be there, Yamina Rare Plants, Ben and Kerry, our very own Ben Brooker from Treasured Perennials, Barrambar Rare Plants, Craig Castry is going to be doing a talk, and he'll be teaming up with Ben and Paul Day from View Gardens to talk about ways that they create their garden in a natural, organic, environmental ethos. So that's the Gippsland Rare and Unusual Plant Fair on Saturday the 10th of October. I think we said last week that it was the 11th as well, but that is not so. Two more left. The Royal Botanic Gardens Melbourne Friends, Growing Friends, have their plant sale on the 17th and 18th of October. It's at the Melbourne Botanic Gardens on the Tropical Glasshouse Lawn. There's some really unusual, rare, native and exotic plants that are grown by the Growing Friends. And similarly with Cranbourne, all the proceeds go into supporting projects at the Botanic Gardens. And finally, finishing on the Yarra Valley Garden Expo on the 7th and 8th of November, 125 Quail Road, Wandon, is on. Again, there's going to be live talks throughout the whole weekend, flower arranging workshops, a whole heap of growers. There's a lot of our beautiful 3CR Gardening Show team that will be selling their plants and selling their seeds and being involved in various ways as well. And you can buy tickets online for that at yarravalleyplantfair.com.au. There is so much going on in Melbourne for plants and gardening. It's awesome. We are through with the committee announcements. Again, if there's any garden clubs out there, you know, APS, any garden clubs, please send us an email, 3cr.gardening@gmail.com. We would love to, give some airtime to the different events, talks and workshops that's going on in the gardening community in Melbourne, in Victoria, and even further afield. We do have a pretty broad range of listeners, especially with the podcast these days. So please do send them through to us. We'd happily, give it some time. So the number again, if anyone wants to join the show, we're here for another 45 minutes, is 94190155. The SMS line is 0488 809 855. I'm Chloe Foster and I have Emmeline Bowman and AB Bishop in the studio with me this morning. AB, you are the horticultural editor of Gardening Australia magazine and you let me write really cool stories about plants that I love. But do you want to give us a wrap-up of what's in the current edition of GA Mag?
Yeah, sure. And this is the September issue, which is out now. And it has lovely mauve brachyscomb, so the cut-leaf daisy, on the cover, inspiring everybody. And that is part of a story written by the lovely Judy Horton we've called the story Forever Flowers, but essentially it's long flowering plants. So those plants that bring joy and colour to your gardens for more than 6 months of the year. Mm. And honestly, there are so many of them. And one of the things that we do in the magazine is we try to have an equal number of native plants and non-native plants. Mm. One of the things that emerged out of a reader's survey that we did last year was that readers cannot get enough of native plants and gardens. Okay. So And the good thing is...
That would have pleased you to no end.
I cannot tell you. And Liz...
So we're not leading the witness.
No, absolutely not. Liz Wilson, our editor, is very native plant minded as well. And to the, you know, sometimes we get to the point where we're like, oh my goodness, we've got all these plant profiles, but we've forgotten to put in a non-native. So let's put it in a non-native. So anyone hasn't picked up the magazine for a while and you're into native plants, you will hopefully be pleasantly surprised. So this Forever Flowers story by Judy, she talks about the Banksia spinulosa dwarf forms, of which there are many. And honestly, they do flower for a long time. So there's a bunch of beautiful native and non-native flowering shrubs and climbers that, flower for a long, long time and are really useful to have in the garden. So that is one of the terrific stories. We've got a couple of tales from the top end, so Darwin Gardens. Always lovely to have that sort of real tropical representation, and that's something else we try to do in the magazine is really try to bring in the different climates in terms of the plants that you can grow and the gardens as well and how gardening is so different. And I mean, I think one of the things we did in Alice, we went to the community garden there, and that was really a good lesson in how different climates, how to garden in different climates. Essentially, they pretty much shut down through summer. So that was a real eye-opener for me. But yeah, so the magazine, we've got Tales from the Top End, we've got Judy's story, we've got Chloe's lovely story on
isopogons.
Yes,
so my sister loves isopogons.
I know, they're great. They're so underrated.
Yeah.
Oh, they're great.
And so, yeah, there's pretty much plenty for everyone. And of course, we always have a strong focus on veggie garden growing, so what to grow and how to grow it. And the My Garden Path, which is the back two pages this month, is on the lovely Andrew Laidlaw.
He's so lovely.
Yeah, so you can read his story. So the head landscape architect at Royal Botanic Gardens Victoria, you can read his story. And honestly, you know, one of the things, so with the My Garden Path, what we do is we send questions to these people. And I just had to laugh at Andrew's, because we usually say, oh, you know, give us about 1,000 words. And Andrew's came back at about nearly 2,000 words. And so much of that was thanking the people that he had been inspired by on his journey
and supported.
And unfortunately, we had to take a lot of those out. There's still a lot in there. But it's just so nice to see someone who's so good at what he does and so renowned to be really humble and thanking all the people that have made him who he is.
He really is
so,
a rare breed.
Yeah, so there's a lot in the September issue.
Lovely. And then the October issue, which is coming out soon, has an Eastern Rosella on the cover, which is so finger on the pulse at the moment, because that bird is so popular at the moment.
Yes.
Well done.
Thank you. And we have a very sort of mini interview with Miles, who was the young lad that wrote the song. And if you haven't heard the song or haven't heard that there is a song, just Google Eastern Rosella song and you can thank me afterwards, because it'll be in your brain for the rest of the week.
Too bad we can't finish this talk off with the Eastern Rosella song.
Oh, yes. My gosh. Oh, I'll see
Friendly
what I can
do. Can you?
Yeah. I don't know. I'll see what I can do. All right. Thank you very much, AB. There's a couple of text messages to get to. Okay, Susie has messaged in saying that our Pia, so Pia Lefebvre, who's been on the panel, but she is one of our producers on the show here as well, was on Gardening Australia on Friday night showcasing her private courtyard garden. And there was footage there from the garden she did at the Flowering Garden Show this year, which was called the Dopamine Garden. And it was just... It was like beautiful. Pia's ethos of what she's doing with her business, of beautiful, creating beautiful, bright.
Bright, happy gardens.
Happy landscapes, yeah. So, and then you got to see what's going on in Pia's very small rental courtyard. She's growing everything in raised containers, polystyrene boxes. Yep. It's amazing. So if you miss Gardening Australia, please do jump onto iView and catch that. Or it's repeated on Sunday afternoons. Double with Landline, which is such a great double on a Sunday afternoon. Yeah. So do try to catch up with that. Naeem has sent in a community announcement. The Brunswick Communities for Nature have an Indigenous plant sale. It is today from 10 until 12, 101 Union Street, Brunswick. Pop down there if you want to pick up some local species. Isabel from Ascot Vale has messaged in, thank you for mentioning that awful Halloween fake spider web and the stupidity of Halloween in Australia.
Go, Isabel.
Yeah, thanks, Isabel. The other horror of Halloween is that it teaches kids to put their hand out for free crap.
Yeah.
I wish we could come up with a replacement tradition that encourages kids to engage with the community in a better, more constructive way. I couldn't agree more.
I completely agree. It's just more capitalism and commercialization and more money-making crap.
It's like, don't worry about stranger danger on one day of the year. Great.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. If you want to join in the chat this morning, we're here for a little bit longer. The number is 94190155. The SMS line is 0488 809 855. We can't get images on the text line. The best way to send us photos if you need help troubleshooting in the garden is via email, and that's 3cr.gardening@gmail.com. The other theme we wanted to speak about today, not only to wax lyrical about this amazing conference that we've been at, but on this Monday, is National Threatened Species Day. It's held on the 7th of September every year and actually started in 1996. But do you guys know the significance of the date?
Yeah.
AB?
About the thylacine. Oh. It's essentially a date to commemorate, in inverted commas, more likely commiserate, the death of the last known thylacine or Tasmanian tiger, which was held in captivity.
Yeah.
So it's a way essentially to remind us that these creatures can disappear. And I did a little bit of a research yesterday just on the number of species that have become extinct, because unfortunately Australia is renowned for
the worst
extinction rate. And essentially extinct fauna is 65 species, critically endangered 150 species, endangered 250 species, and vulnerable 221 species. And it's the same with flora: extinct 35 species, critically endangered 309 species, endangered 615 species, and vulnerable 563 species. And I think it's a really good reminder for us, and that is what Threatened Species Day is really about. It's not only about the critters, but it's also about the flora and what we can do. Of course, habitat loss and fragmentation is a huge part of that, but there's also this sort of unreal fire regimes which are happening now, which are playing into it. But I mean, things like the flora, what we can do in our own gardens. And one of the plants that I brought in today is the chef's cap coria, Coria baulenii, and that is regarded as a vulnerable plant. So it's vulnerable in the wild. It's only found in a tiny area in southern New South Wales. So there are quite a few species. So the Eucalyptus pulverulenta is another one, which is a vulnerable species. And a lot of these plants are ones that we can find in nurseries and can grow at home. So although you're not increasing the genetic diversity of that particular species by growing it, you're certainly able to keep it going. So
yeah, and I mean, you never know. A horror bushfire runs through an area, and there could be a call out for anyone that's got material of these plants in their gardens.
Yeah,
and it can be grown and it can be returned.
Our garden seed banks.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And Cranbourne Gardens have been, and Melbourne as well, been sort of doing that with the Raising Rarity program.
Yeah.
Of researching various rare species, rare in the wild, to assess their cultivation or horticultural potential. And hopefully in the next couple of years we'll start seeing some of those on our nursery shelves.
Yeah, and I mean, Em, you were talking about ants earlier, or we were talking about ants earlier, and Australia has one of the highest diversity of ant species in the world. And it's incredible sort of seeing how they had this interplay between other critters. And one particular that I'm thinking of is the bull oak jewel butterfly, which is a critically endangered butterfly from southeast Queensland. And it is really linked in with the a particular species of ant, which looks after the larva of it. Mm. But the thing with this particular ant is it only likes to walk on logs. So when people have come in and removed logs for firewood, etc., they break the path of those ants. And that's one of the reasons why the butterflies have become endangered. So it's really good to get to know the ecology of a particular species that you might be having in your garden, just to work out what you actually can do to support them. And there are lots of things that we can do in our garden, including creating different layers of plants. So not just about planting indigenous plants, but planting that ground level, that mid layer, which is often missing from gardens, different sorts of shrubs. And again, I have brought in quite a few that are flowering in my garden, the Grevillea rosmarinifolia. I've got two forms. I've got Lutea and I've got Scarlet Sprite, which is red. And honestly, they both flower for months and months and months. Mm. And then, of course, the trees. And we don't have to talk about really huge trees in our garden. We can have 10-metre tree, 15-metre tree, which is creating that upper canopy. And all of those is supporting different critters.
Yeah. I think also there's a point that Chloe made before too, which is really poignant. It's like you didn't realise all those types of mammals or how many there were, right? And it's that thing of like, why are we bang on about all these animal species and just even talking about how these ants have to crawl over logs? It's like we actually need to start talking more about it, because what happens is all these animals start to disappear, animals and plants and these ecologies. And the people who then are born after don't know any better. So you just sort of let this extinction slowly happen because you're just not aware of what was there before. And it's really important that there are all these teachings and caring for our country and caring for the land and the environment, and these plants and animals. So then we're teaching next generations and people who haven't even lived in certain areas where they've seen all this wildlife. So they know that this isn't normal, that we're actually losing everything. And we need to put it back in some way if we can, you know. Mm. It's like, yeah, I see that even as a kid, like the things that I used to see on the farm. We used to see all those big monitors, you know, the large goannas, lizard species, insect species. They're not there anymore. I can have that comparison. Mm. But then Chloe hears about all those little marsupials running around. You've never had that comparison, so you don't know what the old normal was.
Mm.
So it's like that, this is the conversation and this is this day where we really need to open our eyes and learn about what was here and the ways that we can actually put back, because we should be caring for our land and our country.
I think a benchmark that sort of you can sort of see for a lot of people is when you go for a road trip and what used to end up on your windscreen and the front of your car. You know, you get to the end of a road trip, you've been on the road for a few hours and you can't, you've emptied the windscreen wiper fluid, there's dead bugs all over the front of your car.
Yeah.
That does not happen. Not even a quarter of that happens anymore.
You know, Chloe, when we were doing our road trips in Alice around up to Hermannsburg and seeing random horses in the middle of streets and cars parked in the middle of the road. That is one of the things I clocked. Our windscreen was covered in bugs.
Yes.
And you just don't get that around the major cities anymore.
No.
Though when we did our drive down to Uluru, we never saw any roadkill at all. We saw no kangaroos. We didn't see one.
We didn't see much roadkill either.
And, you know, and that's usually a telltale sign of what's, you know, in the area. You know what we did see dead? Fox, cows. That was it.
Yeah.
So there's more cows and foxes than there were animals. We didn't see one kangaroo, not one. Unfortunately, we saw that parenti on one day.
Yeah.
But, it's and I remember, like, when we had done this camp, there was kangaroos littered on the roads everywhere.
Mm.
But it's like when you go to Tasmania, as much as I cannot stand seeing all this dead wildlife, there is like paddy melons and, they've got betong, then they've got kangaroos, and you'd see them nearly every 50 metres, and you're like, well, this is horrible. But the abundance is there.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
There. The same when I go home. I only ever see foxes. And in fact, I saw a deer. And then it's just like, I'm not seeing those animals anymore.
Yeah.
Rabbits, lots of rabbits. So it's pretty, it's getting dire, and we really need to, yeah, start thinking a bit more.
And I mean, the thing is, it's actually relatively easy for us to make a difference as gardeners. And I mean, even Bern ringing in and saying, what can I do for the blue tongue? I mean, this is where it all starts. It pretty much all starts with the insects in our garden. So I often bang on about, if you're trying to create a garden where you see more birds or lizards or frogs, just concentrate on getting your insects in there, making them happy. So avoiding your pesticides, you know, any chemicals, just pretty much find other ways of dealing with an issue rather than by using chemicals, and eventually your garden will come into balance. And keeping cats contained, that's another big one. I mean, one of the things they were saying at Alice is, you know, there's such a high proportion of wild cats around the place, and they're just having this incredibly negative impact on wildlife. So there are plenty of things that we can do as gardeners, which is really good, and you sort of make your garden a refuge for critters. And remember that your one garden is part of a broader picture, especially for birds and even lizards who will travel a reasonable distance. So you're part of a broader kind of patchwork of habitat, really. So you do what you can do, especially things like, you know, creating a verge garden. I mean, in Alice, there was so many verge gardens, weren't there?
It
was quite incredible. So, and quite tall ones too. So, I mean, it is not all doom and gloom. There are certainly things that we can do, and it is possible to be able to reverse a decline of a species. I mean, if you look at Victoria's national bird emblem, the helmeted honeyeater, you know, they've got a captive breeding program at Healesville, and they have been released into the wild, and they are breeding in the wild up in Talangi State Forest. So there are good news stories, and it is possible, and it is, you know, we're all able to make a difference ourselves, which is, you know, well, I'm really thankful for.
If you think about every garden in Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane, and if everyone got around with increasing the species diversity in their gardens, that's, you know, that's really where it can start. It's
and then it extends to larger landowners and holders, and you can do the part there. So
it's kind everyone of not can, that hard. Like, just plant more
plants. It's not. It's actually, it's so easy.
Yeah.
Like, when they say, if you plant it, they will come, it is so true.
Yeah.
And it's also, just being mindful that whatever, if you do have a larger property, you know, try and put things back and set off a percentage just for wildlife, because it actually comes back, like, it, you know, it's like a thing where it actually comes back for you in a good way. You know, you, if you have part of your little habitat and then you give back for the animals, the benefit that you receive is like, You know, we talk about this all the time, but even for, obviously I come from farming background, even farms, percentage of it should actually be incorporated back to the environment. If you have creek, if you have boundary planting, it should be like indigenous plant species or native plants, more indigenous, to be able to have those lots and connective tissues or, you know, corridors for wildlife.
Refuge,
yeah. It's part of it. It's like, if we all collectively did this, it's huge, the transformation.
It would be huge.
And I guess there's, you know, it's not wise to have a talk about Threatened Species Day without talking about the bird flu that's around at the moment, the H5N1 avian virus, which is really having a big impact, particularly on seabirds and shorebirds. But it's starting to move into the mainland birds as well. I mean, it was kind of slightly inevitable, but it is a situation where if you see a dead or dying or suffering bird, definitely report it.
What is the reporting channels for it? You don't have those notes in front of you. Sorry to put you on the spot like that.
It's calling the Animal Disease Hotline on 1800 675 888. And, you know, one of the things that we can do is feed birds less or be more mindful of how you're feeding them so that they're not congregating. Make sure that you're cleaning your bird baths regularly, just so that in case the avian bird flu is in that area, which we hope it doesn't spread too much inland, but certainly, again, we can be making a difference in that regard. I mean, there's 480 events that have been documented in Australia now, so it is here to stay and it is going to have an impact, especially on already vulnerable species of birds. So we want to make it as least problematic as possible. And and you kind of shake your head and you're like, oh, what can I do? It's here. You know, there's only so much you can do. But essentially you keep away. If you see a dead or dying bird, you keep away from it, because although humans can catch it, but you don't have the same effect from it that animals do. But you want to keep your dogs away from any dead or dying bird, and yeah, maybe take a photo, record its location, and report it.
Yeah, thank you very much. The other side to Threatened Species Day is the Bake Off. Which the irony of the Threatened Species Bake Off.
That is so up your alley.
Yeah, it really is. I do like inappropriate humour. So it's a way of increasing the awareness of Threatened Species Day in a really, it can be a really fun way. So a lot of workplaces do get around it. They will have a Threatened Species Bake Off. And I have seen some amazing cakes and other sweet things that have been made in the forms, you know, beautiful rare butterflies. Someone's, you know, made a cake of this beautiful rare butterfly or a caterpillar or an animal of some description. You know, I've seen the team at Melbourne Zoo, the invertebrates team, have gotten around it before. The Cranbourne Gardens horticulture team have had Threatened Species Bake Off before as well. So you can get around this in your workplace. There's sometimes a theme, but yeah, so it's running this week. If your workplace is sort of, you know, that way leaning, Threatened Species Day is tomorrow, but it sort of runs all week. If you do want to organise a Threatened Species Bake Off just to bring awareness, that you just don't know who you might work with that doesn't know about, you know, what, you know, the state of our fauna and flora is. There's some more information on the internet if you just type in Threatened Species Day or Threatened Species Bake Off.
Yeah, and they're on Instagram, so you can you can see the other creations that people are making.
They're incredible. I've been watching it for years. I'm like, oh,
one year we should do it.
We have to. Yeah. Honestly, I'm like, it's so good.
I expect the STEM office to pull out the stops at some point.
We love our treats too. Yeah. Like, we love lollies.
One of the things I'm doing to contribute to Threatened Species Day is every year in Eltham they have the Eltham copper butterfly count, and where you go into particular reserves in Eltham and you don't actually count the butterflies but you count the larvae, and so these are another species of butterfly which are essentially looked after by ants, and every day the ants escort the larvae up, or every night they escort the larvae from their underground tunnels up into the foliage of Bisaria spinosa, where they feed and the ants protect them and they collect their honeydew, and then when daylight comes the ants take them back down into their underground tunnels and look after them.
It's so funny.
So every year you can be part of a count to count them, and if you want to get onto that you can just type in Eltham copper butterfly count, and they're about to start counting this week, so if you're sort of in Eltham or surrounding area, hop onto that, and might see you out in the field at 10 o'clock at night with your head torch counting little white caterpillars.
Oh, you've got a good head torch too. We learned that.
Yeah, it was really good. I want one.
My red
torch.
I still have to show you my thermal imaging thing too.
You do. Yeah. But no,
I need your thermal imaging thing to work out what's digging up my front garden.
Exactly. Too. You can get it out and you can go and see what little critter it will heat up. It's incredible, this device.
Yeah. Yeah.
For those who don't know, it's just like a little device you put on your phone and has an app, and you can record thermal mass. So you can even use it if it's like even for your house, you can see where heat is escaping. But he put it out, I discovered I could see all my little wallabies. I saw a little rat running past. And I was like, oh my God, for animal lovers, this thing is gold.
So do you go out there with your phone or you just leave it recording?
No, it plugs into the phone where you charge it.
Yep.
Tiny little thing with a camera, and then the imagery goes onto your phone so you can see it, and it records all the heat. It's only worth $200 and it's incredible. You can see where everything, I can see, what little critters. And even like if you walk away from the floor that you've walked on, you can still see your little footprints where the heat has been left behind. It's fantastic. Like technology has just gone crazy. Like to buy something like that for $200, seriously.
Yeah. That's
incredibly.
Nice.
That's incredible. Nice. Sorry.
Yeah.
Where were we?
Well, so you are tuned into the 3CR Gardening Show, listeners. I'm Chloe Foster and I have AB Bishop and Emmeline Bowman in the studio with me this morning. We're here until 9:15. There's just a couple of text messages to get to. A listener has asked, with the birdbath cleaning, AB, water only, or is there something else to use, like a disinfectant or something?
Water only, and get yourself a nice brush. Like I have got a couple of really nice brushes and I put them back in the same place each time, usually, and it just makes it enjoyable to clean them and makes it easy. So no, just water, get yourself a brush, or even a handful of soil is fine, but just get that algae off
I do say, though, if you have pet birds or chickens and you want something, you want something to be able to kill off anything, you know, it's F10 spray. We used to use that in animal husbandry, especially with birds.
Where can you buy that?
You should be able to get it from veterinary clinics.
Bird bath?
You could if you wanted to. It's a spray that will kill off any pathogens. I must say, though, we used to use it, and when I'm saying this now, maybe we just need a check to see if it has any other harmful benefits that it doesn't cause, you know, killing of anything else. But it's a veterinary grade disinfectant, and it's really, really good. Oh, there you go. It's the most effective bird-safe solutions for cleaning and sanitizing outdoor bird baths. So there you go. F10 spray. You can buy it online or from veterinary clinics. And it's, you just dilute it in some water. And when you clean, you just give a spray, clean the area. And if you have pet birds, you should always use that too around your bird cage or around the area just to sanitize the area. And that will get rid of any pathogens or any bird flu issues.
Great.
And anything else.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah. Thanks, Em.
F10.
We're here for a little bit longer. If you want to phone in 94190155 or send us a text on 0488 809 855. Kerry has messaged in. She needs advice about a smoke bush, which I'm guessing is Cotinus. She's bought two. They've both died. Seems like they don't like the winter cold. There's just one stalk less left. Will it revive?
I'd say
they're deciduous.
Yeah.
So it should come back. I wouldn't do anything to it. Just wait. It's September now. The weather's starting to warm up.
Buds.
There should be some buds forming, and I think you'll get leaves starting to grow on it.
Yeah,
in the next month or so.
They're cold hardy plants.
Mm. Yep. There's a lot going on in Adelaide garden wise this weekend. And the Horticulture Media Association had their biennial awards night called the Laurels. Now, AB, congratulations.
I didn't know.
Thank you.
Before we go into what you won, I do just want to congratulate Connie Cow.
Oh, yeah.
Won the book Laurel for her book Your Asian Veggie Patch. So Connie's a regular contributor, so huge congratulations to Connie. My Little Rookie Gardener was a finalist as well, and Tammy Huynh's The Plant Book. The three of our three books were there, and Connie's one, which, like, congratulations to Connie because it's such a unique book that she has created. But AB, you got an award.
I did. Thank you, Chloe. And just going back to Connie very quickly, she actually got three awards.
Yeah,
so she shot for social media and the Young Gardener.
Good
award.
Her.
So well done, Connie. Yeah. Very, very well deserved.
Good work.
But yes, so I pretty much won this award for technology and innovation.
Amazing.
But the only reason my name was on it was because I'm a member of the HMA. It is essentially a real team effort. So we won the award, and this is the Gardening Australia magazine, won the award for our new planting guide. So it's a guide online on our website where you can go and put in what climate you're in and what plants are going to be planted. So produce plants are going to be planted at that particular time. So we've got 88 varieties of plants up there, and it's very user-friendly, and obviously I just wrote it, whereas, you know, the IT team are the ones who really bring it to life, and there's been plenty of people working on it as well, but we were thrilled to be recognised. Yep,
that's amazing. Congrats.
Yeah, it was really cool. Gardening Thank Australia you. Mag did very well that night. And, yeah, another congratulations to Connie. She clean swept. Yeah, and,
totally.
I think she was getting something else yesterday too.
AIH.
Yeah.
Cool. She's Go, Connie.
Go, yeah. Go, Connie. Girl. Well done. Okay, Harry has messaged in wondering if we'd care to comment on some small garden design principles to attract small Australian birds, not the bully bird black-faced miners. Oh. This is like a what, girls, what? This is your opportunity.
Is this a planned question?
We have left. Yeah. We've got a bit of time, so we can go into this.
All right, go, Em.
All right, thick bushes. Scrub, you need prickly, thick, dense, all those things. And then it's also about you still need a little bit of grass as well, because you need to be able to produce a bit of seed, because we've got a lot of small birds that actually eat seed. So your poas and diclonacnes and themeters, like that's still producing a seed for all your little finch
so
varieties.
So not necessarily lawn.
Not necessarily lawn. Spot.
Ornamental grasses.
Ornamental grasses. And look into your, you know, native indigenous grasses, because you're going to be blown away by the types of species that you can put in there. And they're still beautiful.
We have so many cool and local species.
Beautiful. So have them in your foreground so you can still get that sort of look. Because obviously if you want like a bush garden and you want it to be sort of like, you know, a habitat and bit, maybe also some people say a bit messy, but I like that. You know, you can have the grasses sort of interweave through, but then you need thick, dense shrub. You need variety. So when you've got frugivore, insectivore, granivores, and predators, they're your different types of bird species. So seed eating, insect eating, nectar eating, and predatory.
And fruit eating.
And fruit eating, the frugivores. Frugivores. So that means that depending on the size of your garden, try and diversify the shrubs that you have in there as well. So you got Caprosma quadrifolia, which is your prickly currant bush. You got the prickles, you got the dense, and you got the fruit. You got grasses, and then you've got your seeds. We can go for different shrubs. So like what AB brought in today, the Coria barolenii and different other Coria species, Grevillea species.
Hakea
decurrens. Yeah, small, dense.
Because I'm just trying to, there's another listener is messaging asking about, they've put in grevilleas to bring in the birds, but they're frustrated because all they're getting is the noisy miner. So I'm just wondering if they've put in the big flowering grevilleas.
Potentially. So you need to go for grevillea rosmifolia. Yeah.
The ones that are going to hurt you.
The ones that will hurt you. Anyway, I can see AB's like,
I need to say something too quickly. We can both say.
Yeah, I'll also say in terms of the grevilleas, so yes, the large flowering grevilleas, they are the ones which will bring in those noisy miners, and also the slightly aggressive other honey eaters, the larger honey eaters. They have those big flowers. Birds have incredibly good eyesight. So if you're planting lots of red flowering or really bright flowering plants, these birds are just, it's like a beacon to them. So they're going to be in your garden. So, I mean, one of the things, I'm in Bend of Islands, and honestly, the only red flowering plant that we have is the Grevillea rosmarinifolia, which has really tiny red flowers. So we don't have these big beacons to attract other sort of pest inverted commas bird species, but yeah, certainly the dense shrubs, and also I will say clean up less. Again, it comes back to the insects. So a lot of these birds, even if they are feeding on plants, that supplementing their diet with insects, so they want to be scuffling around in the understory, you know, through the mulch and through a bit of leaf litter. We have got wrens and a bunch of other small bird species, and they spend their entire day just in the leaf litter scurrying around, and they'll hop up on a little log. So that's another thing, have, you know, a couple of logs or larger boulders that are sort of set into the garden a little bit, which gives them a bit of a perching point.
So, Oh, sorry. And I would also say with the insects, like not only within the leaf litter, you want to try and attract insects through the plants as well. So a lot of your Elaria species, like Elaria ramulosa is a really, really good one. We said before about the Bessaria spinulosa.
Yeah.
That one's a really, really good one. AB just pointed to the prickly Moses, which is Acacia paradoxa.
But that's actually Acacia echinacea.
Oh, that's echinacea. The gold dust. That's gold dust.
It's looking a little bit sad after being in the car
Acacia
all night.
Paradoxa and verticillata are really good.
Really, yeah. Really
any
good.
Of the acacias.
Yeah.
Really good.
But Elaria's for insects and also like a lot of your daisy species. So all your, Xerocrys and Viscosums, even like your probably more Crespeida chrysanthes, which is all like the different types of billy buttons, but not the Pycnosaurus. We find that the Crespeidia varieties, Variabilis chrysanthes, tend to have more of an attraction with insect species.
Cool.
And if you're looking for like something that's showy and a bit more of a cultivar, with the Xerocrys and Viscosum, we have a lot of insect like activity with the it's a hybrid called Daisy Fields.
That one's a cracker. Yeah.
And it's so good. And it's prolific, but the bug life that goes onto these species is next level.
And it's a longer-lived Xerocrysum too.
Yes.
And a lot of those Xerocrysums are host plants for various species of butterflies, as are the grasses. Mm, so you've got to think about that whole ecology and life cycle of the different critters.
That's right.
The daisy flowers, they're like a landing pad for these insects.
Yeah, like a helicopter.
Yeah, like a helicopter. And the same with, carrot plants in the carrot family, Apiaceae. So flannel flowers and trachymene and, even letting
Ozothamnus cassias.
Yes.
Like they're also unsung heroes and should really have more of a...
And small flowers on those too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you can get cultivars of these now as well if you don't want, something that might get too big. You can still get them to 1.2 meters, and that's the dense that you want. And then when you stage that through, you can really, get that diversity in and the little birds. And obviously it takes a bit of time.
Yeah, and I'd say get to know your local indigenous nursery. Mm. Just go down, get two plants.
Yeah.
And see how they go in your garden. Talk to the staff. They're extremely knowledgeable. Tell them you want to be bringing insects into your garden.
Mm.
And they'll help.
Yeah. Or, you want to feed the small, have more small bird diversity in your garden.
And the thing also to consider is, are there small birds in your area? Because it's all very well to be planting up a garden for small birds, but if they're going to find it hard to get to your garden, you might have a creek or bushland reserve half a K away. Are they going to come from there? Sometimes it can be hard to tell. So I suppose don't be too disappointed if you're not getting the small birds in there if they're not in your area already.
Yeah, kind of like where we work, what's really interesting is we've got a really high abundance of more grassland species, and what that has actually caused is a higher proliferation of skink species. And one of the main birds that we have there now are butcher birds.
Oh, I was going to say kookaburras.
And kingfishers. And
kingfishers.
And kookaburras, interestingly. And that's because that type of wildlife that's on the floor is what's drawing in the predator bird species to keep that down. And they also eat, we also have a lot of tiger snakes. And the tiger snakes have live young, and so they're also feeding off the baby tiger snakes. So there's that thing where it's like exactly what AB said. Check your area. Maybe your garden doesn't really find itself leading towards small birds. Maybe it is a skink garden, and maybe you are verging on a creek, and maybe then you are like helping butcher birds and all those sort of things. And the butcher birds are great because they stop those stupid noisy miners.
And getting back to the noisy miners, and we talk about Bessaria spinosa as being such a fantastic plant for habitat, but do you know that the noisy miners actually prefer to nest in the Bessaria spinosa? So double-edged sword.
They nest in eucalypts, and you often, in our public parks, we have a lot of eucalypt diversity and that perfect open space of grass, lawn for them to fly through. But I didn't know they nested in Bessaria as well.
It's interesting too, because it's the eucalypts that's also driven up the numbers of them and the bell miner too, because they produce a little lerp and they eat that little sugary sac, and that's what's, and obviously in combination with ovals and parklands, like we've created the perfect environment.
Well, it is.
It is also like, our environment has created this environment as well. So, It is really important that we do create these gardens that could be dense for other critters to be able to have these isolated pockets of vegetation zones that support wildlife that aren't just our bully birds.
Yeah. I mean, Grevillea rosmifolia is a classic, really dense, thorny shrub, which I can attest to having a few in the garden, that there's literally always birds in them.
Yeah,
always.
But also the pink one you bought in Hakea decurrens, there's a white form and a pink form. When I worked at Karanga, like you'd never see anyone buying Hakea decurrens unless it was in flower. Because it gets covered and it feeds, like, you know, there's heaps of nectar in the flowers, but the fruit of Hakea feeds the seeds as well. It's a bit of an all-rounder.
And that has taken a while to get going. I mean, Hakea decurrens can get up to 5 meters or even more. In my garden, the areas that aren't garden bed, so the sort of natural, the edges of the natural bush, it is really heavy rocky clay, so I literally don't get anywhere in the garden without taking my crowbar with me. And my plants have stayed at about a meter and a half, so that's the sort of good and the bad of having that type of soil. And I mean, and that's one thing that you need to take into consideration if you want your plants to grow quick and you do have that really heavy clay soil. You want to break it up as much as you can, sort of across a bit of a horizontal plane, just to allow those roots to sort of penetrate easier and grow quicker. But I was happy for them to grow slowly, and they're growing slowly but really healthily, and every year putting on a great flower show.
Beautiful. Thanks, Gills. There's been a couple of other text messages come through about lemon trees. So Tim has messaged in. He's got a lemon tree in a pot. It's about 3 years old, fruiting and growing well, but the last few months it's lost all of its leaves. There's new growth starting to develop now. Does he leave it and see what happens? What's your recommendations?
Repot. Depending on when you've last repotted. I mean, lemons in Melbourne this time of year, they're just starting to come out of their sort of slight winter, not dormancy, but they do look a little bit poor through winter.
They can also drop their leaves if they're too wet or too dry well. So just check the moisture levels. You might
check
need
it's draining properly.
Yes.
Yep.
Either way, you might need to adjust by giving it less or giving it more.
Yeah.
And the heavy feeders too. So if you've got it in a pot,
feed it now.
Give it a feed.
Right now before spring starts to.
Exactly. The other citrus-based question from Ross. I'm getting myself a bit confused. There were two lemon questions. Anyway.
Would be disappointing if there wasn't one.
I know. We rarely get them. Ross from the Bass Coast, long-time listener and subscriber. Ross, thank you for subscribing to 3CR. It's a great way to support the station. He missed the start of the heat-sensing camera chat. Where can he find it?
It's called Thermal Master, and you just look online. You'll find it. It's a device that hooks onto the charging port of your phone. It's tiny. It's just like a little square plug.
Yep.
Thermal Master.
I'd type into a Google search Thermal Master.
Thermal Master.
Phone attachment or something.
Yeah.
Yep. This was the other question. So he's got a finger lime. It's healthy, but the foliage is a bit yellow. They can go a bit yellow in the cooler months of the year. But again, might be worth giving it a feed with a blood and bone or an organic sort of base fertilizer or put some compost on it.
Yeah, subtropical plant does look a little bit dismal.
But, yeah, if it's in the ground, it would probably just green up again with the weather starting to warm up, even if you did nothing. So maybe wait a little while and see what it does. But if it's in a pot, it might need a feed.
This was a finger lime. Sorry, I was thinking it was lemon still. I'd say a bit of a feed and, definitely if it's cold. Is it, and also where it's been positioned, if it's like obviously needs a little bit more warmth. So usually when we have those, we put a rock or something next to it, which usually makes it grow a lot better.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah, or maybe it could be a little bit of gravel mulch on the bottom just to keep those roots a little bit warmer.
Yeah.
It's just those little things that you can do because sometimes it gets too cold here.
Yeah, that's a great idea, Em. Yeah, so particularly if it's in a part shade position to get a create a little bit more of a warmer microclimate around it.
Yeah, gravel mulch.
Love it.
And finger limes, they do fantastically well in pots.
Yes.
Yeah, really well.
Yep. Yeah. really
and
well.
I think it's because of the pot is keeps it warm on the outside of the sun. Because we find that when they are putting pots or we put them in garden beds, they do so well because if it's in a metal raised bed, the heat from the bed really makes it happy. Same with like damperas and things like that. We find that they love that warm edge. That's rocks and steel and all that. Like lizards.
Easy things to do that make a difference.
That's right.
Yeah.
Simple.
We've got a couple of minutes left. AB, is there another plant that we haven't touched on in your beautiful arrangement today that we could? You picked the most boringest one.
I knew
you were going to say it was all right.
I love that you said what I was thinking. I'm like, what? That's better.
Boring to you too, but okay, so there's three that I want to talk about.
I have to say with Goodenia vata, with the prostrate form, the rabbit's don't eat it, it's really good that way.
Okay, this is Goodenia vata, the hop Goodenia. It comes in three different forms. It comes in a slightly taller, like up to 2 meter shrub. It comes in a dwarf form, which is fantastic for pots, and it comes as a ground cover form. And like, you can poo-poo it all you want, girls, but honestly, the butterflies love it.
It's just really green and get gold stuffed for design. Okay, let's move on to the melissitis, because that's cool.
Melissitis. Yep. This is the tree violet, which is a very underrated shrub, and it has got the teensy winsiest little bell flowers that are cream and flowers sort of, obviously, this time of year, September through to October, really beautifully scented, but you have to really shove your nose in. But this is a gorgeous sort of shrub, almost small tree to 5-ish meters, has lovely long green leaves, and
even though you said that you could shove your nose into it, the thing is that's growing on Mary Creek and Darabin Creek at the moment, and it is,
and you can smell it.
You can smell it everywhere. It's a bit like the Baronia. You put it up to your nose, you can't smell it. It's infiltrating the air from further away. Yeah. So everyone says it smells really good. This is the plant responsible, and you would never know it.
No, you would never know by its tiny, tiny flowers. But yeah, look for it in indigenous nurseries. And the third one, Chloe, I know you're going to get very excited about, is the woolly pomaderis. And this is a slightly bedraggled specimen. It's in our local area, and it's near the road, and it's a very dusty road, and it's kind of covered in dust. But it looks good. I've taken a photo, so I'll put it online, from Vic, New South Wales and Queensland, and kind of an underrated shrub. It's quite wild. 1-3 meters tall by a similar width, and is one of those plants which you can grow under trees. So really good if you've got mature ukes or something and you're trying to grow something. And there is a dwarf form available. So that is the Pomaderis lanigera, or the woolly pomaderis. You've got lovely felty leaves, and usually it looks a little bit rusty as well. So it's just a different sort of colour to have through the garden.
Pomaderis are cool.
I'd love to dedicate a show to pomaderis and spiridium. They are so underrated.
I love spiridium. They're so good.
I know.
Man. For design, they're like our best plant too, because you can complement everything through there, because it's got the green and the little white tips bring it all together. You could have white flowers, you could have like, say, Coria alba, or there's like some plant that's a little bit silver. If you put that spiridium in, boom, everything goes all together, and you're like, I don't know why this looks so good.
Spiridium. What a winner.
It's compliment. And last thing was really beautiful. You know, when you see things that look really nice in nature, one thing part of our Alice Springs trip was that all the plants there had a silvery, glaucous sort of foliage colour.
Yes.
And when you see that all in mass and how the plants all work together, you see that complement through the landscape.
Contrasted on the red rock.
Right.
Yep. Trophina Gorge.
Yes. But this is where, again, comes back to good design, is the complement of colour in the right context and environment.
Yep.
And that's where you really see it. So, people, go into nature, observe it, look at beauty, understand why it's beautiful, it's simple, it's like colour balance, it's natural materials, come on.
Don't try and put all colours in a garden bed.
And please don't put prime colour architecture anymore, no more boxes, please.
What a way to finish. All right, we've come to the end of another 3CR gardening show. That was the melissitis tree violet. Someone messaged in asking about the smelly plant AB just had. End of another 3CR Gardening Show. Oh. Emmeline Bowman, AB Bishop, thank you so much for coming in this morning.
Wish we had
thank
another you. Hour.
Yeah,
I know. We didn't even get to talk about everything.
I know.
Go to Alice.
We yeah, did go well. To Alice.
Go yep. to Central Australia. Di McKenzie, Doug Humbert in thank the studio, you guys. Thanks for keeping us in line. To Daniel Jackson for doing the socials, thank you. Tom thank McLaren you. For doing our podcast, uploading. You're a legend. Stephen's on next week with Greg Balderston and Craig Wilson, and I'm coming in too. So have a lovely Sunday. Happy Father's Day to my dad and all the dads out there.
And happy Father's Day to my Fajar.
Yeah, and have a great day, everyone. See you next week.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.